Welcome to Roots and Ruminants, your podcast for creative and innovative use of farm, pasture, and rangeland. We're going back to the basics of raising and grazing livestock, growing your own forage, and practical land use.
Welcome back to Roots and Ruminant Podcast. Got another great episode in store for us to sit down and talk with a great producer from Southwest Minnesota. We're going to speak with Ben DeWire. You got myself, Justin Frickte, and the co-host, Jared Knock, once again. This is going to be a good podcast because I think we're going to cover a lot of things from farming to raising livestock to some soil health and pieces as well. So with that, we're just going to turn it over to Ben, like what we always do, and have him give us an overview of his operation, what he's doing. So take it away, Ben. Give us the history of where you're at, what you're doing, and a little bit about yourself.
Yeah. Like you said, my name is Ben DeWire, and I live in Arco, Minnesota, kind of in the southwest corner, not too far from the South Dakota border. I farm with my wife, Christy, and we have two daughters, Madison and Sarah. All of them are pretty active, you know, in the farm. They're still pretty young, getting their feet wet, but it's fun. Kind of a family operation. So anyways, we raise crops. We raise corn, soybeans, and primarily oats. Small grains, we try to keep a third of each one. So we have a three-crop rotation, try and keep as even proportion as we can. Most of the stuff we raise is actually conventional. Not because we do, we do raise Roundup Ready corn when I need to. It's not a situation where we feel so strongly that it needs to be that way. It's just we're because we have smaller acres, we're trying to shoot for premium market. So a lot of the stuff we raise is food grade. The soybeans are all food grade beans and the oats are too. So we're trying to maximize our income potential by shooting for the specialty market. So that's why we do it. And then we put cover crops on most of our acres, try and add livestock integration into the cropping situation as much as we can. And then we also have a cow-calf operation it's primarily all forage-based. We are actually calving right now. We do, it's probably almost more like summer calving out on grass. We do have a handful of chickens that we run around out on pasture too, and occasionally some pigs around, but mostly it's just cattle.
Nice. So you're calving now.
Yep.
Let's go through that just a little bit, okay? So I struggle with this as far as timing of calving, and that's like the big debate is if you're a cow-calf producer, when's the optimum time to calve? I'm going to give you an overview of my calving season and what it looks like, and then I want you to tell me what yours looks like, okay? So we originally started calving, 1st of April, consistently. Start with heifers and then cows the 10th of April. Started pushing that back after you get burned with a few early snowstorms. And then now we're probably starting like the 20th of April. But then that pushes us back to now. 1st of July is when we're kind of finishing up. Some of the struggles I see is those early calves are awesome when we move through pastures. Those calves that were just born in the last week are little turds when you're rotating through pastures.
Yeah.
But they're healthy. I never touched them. They maybe got an ear tag if I caught them early enough. But hey, I talk about a low-maintenance system that just works. Let me hear your overview of calving now and what you love about it, maybe some of the struggles about it.
And so just to kind of give you a hint, we used to calve in April, March and April. And that was when we were probably more focused on the feedlot end of it. But we always finished our own calves. But part of the reason was we all been through those April snowstorms and know how much fun they are. And there's nothing funner than carrying a newborn calf that's covered in snow and you're knee-deep in mud with mom chasing you down because she doesn't want you touching that calf and you're trying to tromp through the mud. So we moved it back to May. And I was still having a couple one-offs that were born in the yard, and it's so much more fun to move pregnant cows that are not with a calf at side out to pasture than it is trying to move pairs. So then we pushed it back even further, and then wanted to make sure we were past planting season too. So there's some conveniences that we moved into it, but you know, we'll start calving right around mid-June.
Yep. Wow.
And honestly, it's, you know, it used to be where everybody was bringing their calves in the fall.
Yeah.
And the feedlots would, you know, when I was a kid, a lot of our farmer feeders, you would buy your, you know, like my parents and all the neighborhood, they'd buy their calves in the fall. You'd feed one group and it was done. Now, you know, this system is year round. So it's not,
oh yeah,
it doesn't really matter when that calf is going. You just, once you make that jump, you still have that cash flow at a certain time of year, but it really saves a lot of money on inputs. You know, we're going through winter without her going through her third trimester. So the coldest time of year, I can feed really poor forages.
Yeah.
And then ideally we have them out on grass for 45 days before calving, and they will swell up like ticks. You know, they will really get fat. And then you're out there calving when you got June, when you have the most grass that you have available, and it's really highly nutritious right at that time.
It does make a lot of sense. But I would remind you, June 15th is still spring, right?
Yep.
Because summer does not start till the 20th, 21st. And so this has always made me laugh, because people do spring calving start in like December, like Christmas, you know, like if a purebred breeder, right? You know, they're trying to, you know, calve early enough so they can get their, you know, bulls, yearlings, which are really 18 months old by the time they get used. They'll start the spring calving herd in like end of December, 1st of January. It's like, well, that's not really spring. It's actually just the beginning of winter, you know, that when you're starting calving. And people who are fall calving start in the middle of August, which is also still the middle of summer, you know. And so it's like the spring calving season starts like the end of December, 1st of January, and the fall calving season starts in the middle of summer.
Yeah.
It's like they're both wrong. So you're actually still spring calving, you know.
Well, you know, and when I first started thinking about doing this, I talked to one of the grazing specialists at NRCS, and he was originally from South Dakota. And he told me, he goes, number one, you got to learn how to let your cows be cows. He goes, you aren't going out there 3-4 times a day to check them. You're not going to have your calving barn there. He goes, so if you know you have problems, if you have to help that calf nurse or anything like that, he goes, you just send her to town. Anybody who knows is going to have issues, or if she's got big teats or something, he goes, just out. You can't mess with that. And he goes, you want calving ease. He goes, you don't want 120-pound calves being born out there. You want them small and up and going.
What does Kit Farrow say? I think he says, love your wife, forgive your children, and do neither for your cows.
Yep.
Yeah? Is that it? Did I get it right? Yep. Okay, good. All right. I didn't look that up, so I wanted to make sure I attributed that correctly.
You know, and when you started doing it in the winter months, and then you move to spring/summer calving, you almost feel lazy. Because I can go out and check them in shorts and tennis shoes.
Sure.
And, you know, I mean, the system just works. They just pop out. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing you learn is just to get your fingers out of the mix.
Yeah.
You know, especially like now they got tall grass. I'll go out there and I'll see some afterbirth hanging out of the cow or a little bit. And you're like, okay, well you had a calf, but you're not having a fit. Mm-hmm. I might not see that calf today.
Yeah. Chances are good you won't find that calf.
But it's like, as long as she's not having a fit, I don't need to be worried. And like you said, moving those new ones when you're rotating is hard. So at first, you just maybe don't back fence as often.
Okay.
Because I like to back fence, don't like to let the cows go back more than 4 days, from, you know, let that grass recover. But sometimes we'll give them a little bit more just because those calves will go back and lay. And mm-hmm. But usually they're small, you know, and your polywire is 30 inches tall. They'll be a day ahead, too. They'll be in the tall grass that they're going to. And that's just, that's
move
just
the cows, fine. The calves will follow.
Yep. I that was the hardest thing was to learn. You don't have to see them right away.
Yeah.
As long as the mother's not having a fit, you know everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That system would be better than what we try and chase all the cows and calves through a tiny little narrow gate that's not well positioned. You know, that's like what we are moving cattle, and that doesn't work for newborn calves. But I mean, yeah, just like moving polywires, you know, letting them have some spread. They don't have to, you don't have to push them off where they're at right now. They're going to move to the next one. Conceptually, that makes some more sense. The other thing, so Justin and I have very similar calving days too. And the thing that I guess maybe, I don't know, not frustrates me about like that middle June calving, whereas I've always thought is like, because it's the end of calving.
Yep.
And I don't care when you start, the end of calving is always just like, ugh, you know, like it just, it's your pathogen load is built up, especially if you're not being able to rotate as much as you want to, you know, like the cows that you're like least favorite ones are calving now. And it seems like there's more stuff that comes up and you're not quite into it. So
I hear what
maybe
you're
if you're starting the middle of June instead of ending the middle of June, you'd have a whole different attitude.
Yeah. You know, that's a great point. Your tail enders, no matter when you calve, are always going to be pain in the butt ones.
Yeah.
And you're going to see some issues.
You know, one thing I was seeing almost every year, though, is when I was calving earlier, my ones that I would just kick out to grass at the end would sometimes move up almost 30 days when they were born out on grass.
Oh, really?
I would always have one or two that would be one of the later ones, and then next year she would be right in the mix or earlier. And so for me, that was kind of like, okay, something in your system you know, is telling you to mm-hmm. maybe move them back. That was just my own personal experience, not saying I yeah. probably was missing something.
Well,
in the yard.
But that also, you know, it pushes your breeding date back to, what, September?
Yeah, so instead of moving the bulls out on 4th of July, we're doing it on Labor Day.
Yeah.
Starting to cool down. But you still have spermatogenesis 60 days out, right? So you still have the July-August heat potentially affect. Any issues, you think, with bull fertility going that late?
I haven't noticed it yet. Yeah. But yeah. Okay. So another interesting spin I do on that, though, too, is I run my calves as yearlings the next year, too.
Ah.
So I rough them the whole winter.
Yeah.
And then let them really put the weight on in the spring, and then we'll sell them in October. And we'll actually leave them on the cows most of the winter because they'll kind of wean themselves. But the first year I did that, we weaned the calves like we would in December.
Yeah.
And just letting them nurse just a little bit through the winter really makes a big difference on the health of those calves and how well they do.
I bet.
And you find out the cows that can't handle it, and those leave.
Okay. So when do you officially pull the calves away from the cows, or don't you?
End of May.
Okay, like right before the calf.
Mm-hmm. Usually when I'm taking the cows out.
Okay.
Which, it's just, we keep it simple, but it works.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you find out the ones that can't handle it.
Then they're pretty much self-weaned.
Yep.
And no.
Yeah, they don't really care. When I move the cows out, they really don't care.
They're probably happy.
Yeah. You don't have like those nose spiky things.
Nope.
What are those called? Anybody know?
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, yeah, they use them up in Canada.
Know. Everybody knows. Yeah. No, don't eat them. Just, okay. Cool.
Golly, what are those called? Self-weaners or something like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think if I describe it, I'll get it wrong.
They're not going to work in a low-maintenance system. No, nope. That's one more thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're, okay, so then you're running your yearlings back on grass, and then you're marketing them in the fall then?
Yep, usually about October. We'll take
and what do they weigh in?
You know, honestly, we're not pushing them real hard. Usually they're in that 700 to 900-pound range.
And then, okay, so then you hit the...
Yeah, they're going to be in the... Yeah, they'll be in the grass cattle market or the yearlings, so...
Yep. Are you marketing them as grass-fed?
No, but we do market them at the sale barn as 100% forage, you know.
Sure, sure, yep.
Because then they'll be nice and green, so they usually...
Oh, yeah, got some frame on them.
Yep. The goal is to eventually do grass finishing.
Yeah.
But we want to maintain flexibility so we can take them to sale barn or, you know. And the other thing is that gives us a little bit of drought resilience. If half of my stocking rate is going to be yearlings, mm-hmm. if we need to move cows to, you know, calves to town, it's easier to get those out of the way.
Yeah.
And make room for the cow herd.
Yeah. So what don't you like about that system?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't lie to you. It's pretty easy.
Well, you're joining us for a podcast in the middle of calving season, right?
Yeah.
I think of a lot of people, you know, started calving in 1st of March or 1st of February would be like, I can't come. Yeah. It's calving season. Yeah. I don't go anywhere. I don't do anything.
I've been up since 2.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, if I'm thinking about it, probably the one thing that I never had to deal with before that you do when you calving in the heat like that is fly strike.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay. Doesn't happen often, but I might get one a year where that happens.
Oh.
And is that if they get a little loose and get scoured, you get fly strike?
No, it's usually if the mom doesn't get them licked off clean enough and they got some afterbirth and you'll get some flies laying eggs.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that's some pretty...
Get a little placenta left on their back or something.
It's usually what it is.
Yep. Yep.
But it's not... It's one at the year at the most.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Ah. It's always a... It's got to be a downside to something. Nothing's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, nature's fly strike, frostbite.
Nature's not a perfect place.
Yep.
I mean, it's perfect, but it's not.
It's not friendly.
It's not always friendly. There you go.
Yep.
Yes. Everything's got to eat.
Yeah. True, true.
That's how I should say that.
So on those, with your cows and calves grazing at the end of the summer, into the fall, what are you doing so that cow's nutritional plane is still good while she's lactating heavily in the fall? You mentioned cover crops. Are you doing some crop aftermath stuff?
Well, honestly, we do some. We actually, more of the cover crop grazing, we bring other cattle in.
Okay.
But probably the biggest thing we've done is we've added a lot of red clover to our pasture. And then we do daily moves. So the forage quality really levels off. I'll usually have green leafy forage all the way into December. And so you can, if you're moving daily and you keep moving through and you're giving about 60 days rest or better between, and you're getting good trampling, you've usually got pretty high quality forage. It's almost like June year round. And come, you know, June, you're going to go out there like right now, probably going to see 70% grass, 30% red clover. You come back in August, it's going to be 60-70% red clover and a lot in grass. But the cows, we've never had problems with both. As long as you move them every day, same, you know, we've seeded it so that the pasture is pretty uniform. So it's almost like doing chores. They're eating the same diet every day. If they're used to eating red clover like that, they don't bloat, they don't gorge on it. You move them about the same time every day.
Your rumen microbial load should be acclimated to that amount of red clover.
Yep. And they just really roll through it pretty easy. But that makes a big difference because you've got high-quality forage all the way through the year.
What's your predominant grass species then you're starting out with?
Probably a lot of orchard grass.
Okay.
We got, well, like some of the introduced stuff, we did orchard grass. We've got a little bit of Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, Timothy, you see the seed heads, but it's not like, it's not a heavy
hitter.
It's
a lot of stem. Yeah, it's a lot of
stem. Meadowbrome, we've got some of that. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
We've got some crested wheat grasses out there and intermediate wheat grasses.
Mm-hmm.
Got some canary grass.
Okay.
That stuff, you know, that canary grass is kind of an overlooked grass. That's one of them. You get them low spots. If you can hit that one, like that one likes to be beat up a little bit.
Yeah.
If you hit that guy every 30 days and you keep it down to that 20, 30 inch range, those cows will just go to town on it. Yeah. And it's good forage as long as you can keep it from going to seed.
Yeah.
But you got to kind of beat on it.
Right now, Reed Canary looks like a very great grass because it's the only thing green in everybody's waterways or creek pastures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go back to the red clover stuff. Did you do those seedings at the time that you planted your grass? Were those overseedings? How'd you go about that?
They're all added in after we did it.
And you broadcast
pretty much, Yep, pretty much all of them are broadcast in that January, February, March range.
So frost seedings with snow,
with a four-wheeler, yep.
Yeah, and a four-wheeler.
Usually it's when you get a spot where you can see a lot of ground.
Sure, you know, get some bare dirt.
Because all of a sudden you'll get a spot in the winter, like, oh, we had our January thaw. And I can get that stuff underneath the next big snowstorm. Mm-hmm. Or you do it in March when you can see it. But
sure.
I've tried doing it on snow, and it just washes into the spots you don't want it. So
So is it – how old is your – or how long ago was your first, you know, overseeding like that? I mean, 5 years?
Probably seven.
7 years. Is it staying consistent? Is it getting more prominent? Is it starting to go away – at, you know, 7 years in compared to some of the earlier stuff or the ones you've done more recent?
Yeah. See, so we were getting into a cycle where, you know, it's a biennial, so you'd get every other year, you'd get a clover flush.
Okay.
So I reseeded in between. So it's like you have two waves going.
Oh, you have like two, so you did it 2 years
that,
in a row.
Yep. So that, that level.
Waves.
So then you got opposing waves filling it in.
Huh.
And usually like when I move through now, you go and look at the clover, you know, if the flowers turn brown and it's gone to seed, there's not a lot of viable seed in it now.
Okay.
But come August and September, that next rotation, that you can break, there'll be a lot of seed. So it'll reseed itself, and you can kick the manure pads open, and there'll be seed all over in there.
Uh-huh.
So once you get on that rotation, you can keep seeding it. It'll kind of keep reseeding itself.
Ever seen a situation where you looked at it and like, that's too much red clover? I wish I had more grass.
First time I ever grazed red clover, I remember I had a little patch that was like probably a half acre big.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my gosh, they're all going to be dead tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I was freaked out. And now it's like, I go into 100 acres, you know, and it's predominant, looks like an alfalfa field.
Did they all die then?
They didn't.
Oh, they didn't. Oh, okay. You didn't really finish that story. So I was like, oh, what happened?
See, and we'll actually graze my oats that I plant. We'll underseed all that with red clover as a cover crop. And we'll graze that in the fall too. And that's pretty much red clover with some volunteer oats and stuff coming up. And we haven't had any issues with that either. But the cows are usually used to it kind of too.
Well, you introduce yourself as a corn, soybean, wheat farmer. I feel like you're more like a red clover farmer from Arco, clover Minnesota.
I'm like the Johnny Appleseed of red clover. Yeah. If a little's good, a lot's better, right?
That's great.
I will say the first time my brother, he put some cows out on grass. And because I'm a smart aleck, the next morning I called him up and I was like, Tony, you got dead cows everywhere. And he's like, huh, I was just out there 15 minutes ago. I know you're.
So what you said your oat crop, you underseed it with red clover.
Yep.
So you're planting oats for grain.
Yep.
For the food market. And then you're throwing a little red clover in it at the same time of planting?
Yep. We're putting about 8 pounds of medium red clover in with the oats.
Does the red clover ever get tall enough to hinder your oat crop?
Nope. No, it hasn't. And pretty much when you swat the oats, it's maybe an inch or two tall. And then then she comes on really good. I did have 1 year where we got like 10 inches of oats when it was, or 10 inches of rain when it was in the windrow, and that did start growing through. But the oats were pretty poor at that point too.
Yeah.
So that was not a normal situation.
Was that 2019?
It was 2018.
Oh.
Oh.
18. No, you were right. It was 19. It was 19. You're right.
It rained 10 inches every time it rained.
Yep. Yes. That was 19. Yep. There was no, the oats started sprouting in the windrows, and the combine was just pulling whole mats of like roots and stuff. And it was just not, there was nothing fun about that one at all.
That's not the kind of roots that we want to promote here on Roots and Ruminants.
They should, you could have like sold those into the, what's that market now?
Where the sprout is.
Sprout market. Sprouts and oats. That sounds like a podcast name.
Sprouts and Oats. In our sister podcast, Sprouts and Oats, will be on next week.
Yeah, I know. And like, you know, usually I got a couple neighbors. Like this year, neighbor that's got pasture right in between 100 and some acres of oats of mine, he's going to put all of his out there. So we've got poly wire and stuff to be able to fence in a half section or whatever at a time. And so he's actually going to graze my cover crops this year.
Okay.
Out there.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
It's a good way for, it works good for both of us. He gets some extra feed. I get the livestock integration of the manure on the field. And then we'll let it green back up in the spring and no-till corn into that.
That red clover will come back in the spring.
Yep.
And the no-till corn. Do you think you're getting any nitrogen fixation off of that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the goal. Yep. You know, this year we let it get about knee-high before we planted into it. And had I known the rain was going to shut off when we planted, I probably would have killed it 2 weeks earlier. But you don't know.
Yep. Oh, there's always something. I mean, so well, a lot of the, I think, folks that are doing cover crops and trying new things, and they can say, well, a lot of people, I'd say a lot more in my area, seeded into rye stands this year than normal.
Oh, for sure.
And you know, it's a tough year for that. Mm-hmm. Also, if it doesn't rain, it doesn't really matter on everything else. Everything else is like right to the line anyway. Just as many years or probably more in our area where it's too wet to plant, where that cover actually helps us get in, right? So there's pros and cons to both systems. Yeah. But yeah, you know, there's times where, yeah, it doesn't work out perfect. But there's plenty of times where just the regular conventional recipe for raising corn and soybeans doesn't work out perfect either. And we don't blame that recipe. So.
Like this year is one of those years it didn't work out perfect. My corn is not super stellar, but we get some rains, it'll turn around. It happened last year too. It goes through it. When you plant into that thick red clover patch, it goes to a really kind of ugly stage.
Okay.
Because it has to get through that thick mat.
Yeah.
But then she comes on late season, and it really turned out well. You just have to have faith in the system, but it's hard to do.
Have you done that with rye, too?
So I got, this year, I had two different fields that we had rye and red clover together.
Okay.
And that's probably going to happen next year a lot, because it is unbelievable the difference that little bit of rye made with the red clover. The corn did not have any issues coming through that stand whatsoever. It looks, it's almost two leaf stages ahead of it. The other stuff planted the
same
time.
You're saying the corn liked the rye ground better than the straight red
clover? No, it was red clover and rye together.
Okay.
And the two together was like throwing gas on a fire. At least that's what it looks like. We're going to see how it goes, but I'm probably going to put rye into all of my red clover this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And I got a better kill on the red clover too.
Okay.
For whatever reason, you know. Because when you get a thick stand and you go out and terminate it, getting to the very low plants on the bottom is really impossible.
Yeah.
But with the red clover or the rye, I think that rye really stunted them and helped those little ones hold them back.
Yep. One of the things, I've got a field of corn growing in rye that we took off as balage end of May. And kind of like what you're saying, that corn coming up through that thick mat of red clover, it's a little sick right now. Stand looks good, but definitely behind. But boy, is it a clean field. There ain't no weed growing in there. That rye allelopathic effect is real.
Like my soybeans, all my soybeans are put into rye. So we'll put, you know, about 90 to 100 pounds of rye down in the fall. No-till into the corn stalks. And then, we'll no-till soybeans into that. And the same thing. Other than a little bit of grass coming, it's pretty clean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are you mentioned... all of your small grains and soybeans are going into the food grade market. At what point in your farming career, what made you make that switch? Was it just because you saw some premiums there and you knew you could do it? Or what made you go, there's a really cool opportunity. Let's go this route now.
Yeah, mostly for premiums.
Yeah.
You know, oats are probably my favorite crop to grow. And it's hard to get it, you know, but if you can get into that food grade market, it adds a lot of money to it and makes it cash flow a lot easier. But it's a lot harder. I mean, you got to really kind of watch it because test weight is king.
Okay.
And you got to be in that 38 plus pounds to usually make it. I mean, they'll take down to 36, but you really need to be 38 to 40 some pounds. So, you know, your variety selection is pretty key.
Yeah, 32 pound oats just does not cut it anymore, does it?
It's like I feel like the seed industry should change that standard.
Yeah.
If you had 32 pound oats, which is the industry standard of what an oat is measured upon for selling in the seed industry,
right.
But nobody wants them.
No. Won't take them. Some people won't even take them at that, yep. Right?
I mean, no.
Well, if Asta's listening.
Yeah.
Should maybe bump your... That's a big change.
All the people listening that are in charge of setting the standard test weight for oats at USDA, yeah. Please contact us after the podcast. We have some ideas for you.
Well, and that's, you know...
Should clear it up.
Yeah.
That's where when you're seeding your oats, too, you really got to do it like a population, like you do your corn.
Yeah.
You know, you got to know what your pure live seed per pound is and calibrate your drill because it can vary a lot. Some are going to be like 12,000 seeds per pound. Some are going to be like 14,000 mm-hmm. seeds per pound. Mm-hmm. So it's just amazing how much, yeah.
You dial it in.
Yep. I mean, the good oat seed, the stuff that's going to be high test weight, is going to have lower seeds per pound. So you got to kind of really know what you're doing, otherwise you're going to underseed it accidentally.
This is a lot more in-depth than I think most people have conversations at their farms when they plant oats. You know what I mean? I think most is like, oh, it's oats.
Yeah.
Do we want to do 2-ish or 3-ish or 4-ish or 1-ish bushels per acre?
Yeah.
And does the drill out of seed or does it have seed still in it? You know, that's kind of how most oat seeding goes. But like I said, it all depends on the intensity that you put into it is how much you get out of it.
Yep.
Right? So if you treat it like a, you know, a punt, it's going to look like a punt.
Yep. Like usually when we're usually shooting for a little over 1.5 million seeds per acre.
Okay.
Because we're shooting for a final stand in that 1.2 range.
Mm-hmm. What are some varieties you like over there?
Pearl.
Minnesota Pearl.
But I do have 20 acres this year of Rushmore.
Oh.
I had to flip a lot of rocks over to find it
in
Minnesota. But see how that one, you know, it's 2 days earlier.
Okay.
Maturity than Pearl is. But a lot of trials, it's like you look at them too, and they're neck and neck on yield. They're both white hulled oats. They both have really good test weight and milling qualities. So I completely forgot they were different maturities until it came time to put fungicide on. And I was out scouting, and all of a sudden I looked, I'm like, oh, shoot. You know, the Rushmores are starting to head out, and it was time to get moving. And the Pearl wasn't much more than a day or two behind. But, yeah, I did show up, you know, when they started heading out.
What other things are you doing to bump test weight and quality besides picking the right variety?
Well, I think fungicide is pretty key with oats, especially timing of it. You want to be right at that flag leaf, you know, between flag leaf and like 3/4 to a half head emergence.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like when you get to fungicide season on oats, you better have your sprayer washed and ready to go.
Okay.
Because
happens quick.
Feels like the window's like, you know, 1 to 3 days.
Yeah.
And you don't know when it's going to be windy or rainy or what's going to happen. And it's always, no matter how hard you try to be prepared, it's always a panic. It's like, you come with, oh gosh, we got to really move. But no, variety is really key. We bump up our fertility a little bit on it, trying to get a little more out of it. I also do some, put some products that kind of help with root stimulants and stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Keep that plant healthy.
Yep.
Make it fill.
And scout a lot, you know. Last year we got hit really hard with grasshoppers. And so, I mean, I saw them take almost a third of the oats last year, which was not fun.
No.
So this year, I actually, when we were putting fungicide on the morning before, I happened to be walking around, and there was little grasshoppers out there already. And you would have mistaken them for mosquitoes. They were 1/4 inch tall. But you could see them down in the lower canopy. So I'm like, all right, they're there. Let's get rid of them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Normally, I'd say the level of intensity that you're talking about, the management of the oats, wouldn't be conducive for raising a whole other species at the same time, like red clover in the middle of it. You know what I mean? Like the moment we're talking this intensity, it'd be like, oh yeah, like it's, you know, keep it feel clean, no competition. But we're talking about this level of scrutiny, intensity, and raising a grain crop. And you're telling us that you also have a cover crop growing simultaneously with that field at the same time. Neat.
you know, and part of the reason we started doing that program is because we got into a situation where we were seeding it afterwards. One year, it'd be too late. Next thing you know, it was like middle of September, late September. We're still trying to get our cover crop put in behind the oats. And then it would, when we got an early frost that year, about 2 weeks later, it got started and froze off. And, or, you know, at least I knew if I put it in with the oats that we were going to have a cover crop growing. I can get it established in the spring pretty easy. If we run out of rain, at least it started already. It just takes a lot of pressure off in the fall trying to get that cover crop seeded.
You got one pass.
Yep.
One seeding pass.
And, you know, there's some herbicide considerations with that because a lot of the really cool ones you want to use to clean up your small grains, you can't use because it'll kill the oats. But usually use generic MCPA.
And that won't kill the red clover.
Oh, and it works. Yeah, we've had – it really works pretty good. So,
Remember a couple of years ago we did that instead of just planting oats and peas? We did oats and peas and turnips and radishes and, like, the whole, like, cover crop gamut, lentils and everything all at the same time.
Yeah.
And then we went and chopped the oats and drove – all over that field. I thought there'd be nothing left, right? Kind of same thing. Like, you drive all of that red clover, like, oh, you're going to have places where it's going to kill it all because you drove there. And then you get done with it, and it's like, no, it just comes back, right? You can drive on top of all this stuff once it's established, and it just bounces back. Can you even tell where the grain cart or combine or some heavy equipment was even driving in the field a month later? Can you still see the wheel tracks?
Sometimes. It's usually like when you're – see, we bale up the straw, too. So if I'm where I – there's a – spot that I like to drive on across the field, sometimes you can see it a little bit, but by spring you really can't.
Which is amazing because you're on that field a lot. Are you taking these oats straight? You laying them down?
We swath them.
Yep. All right, so you're swathing, you're picking up you had a grain cart or some kind of other equipment out there to take the grain off, then you're going through and you're baling, then you're running over with a loader tractor getting the bales off. I mean, you're driving on that field a lot for it to not be that noticeable with the interseeded cover crop early on. Have you ever experimented with any other kind of clovers, or are you pretty committed to red clover?
I haven't really experimented. You know,
I think he's committed to red clover.
I have in the pasture.
Yeah.
That we've used some white clover, we used some Ladino.
Okay.
And beer seam and some of those, but I just have an easier time. Red clover is just, it works.
Johnny Appleseed didn't plant a lot of pecan trees.
No.
He knew what he wanted.
Right. When you know what you want, you just go for it.
Yep. No, and I've tried some crimson clover with interseeded with the corn. That's one I've kind of struggled with to get to work, you know, at a noticeable scale for me. But I have seen it come up in the spring where it didn't, you know, you get a dry year like last year. I had it in some of my mixes we put on with the corn, and it didn't really come up. Well, this spring she did.
Okay.
So, yep. Seeds sat there dormant.
Yep. It just was too dry last year. Just didn't do much.
Yep.
But those small, hard seeds, they can last a while.
Yeah, sure can. So you mentioned that you're going to have a neighbor come in and graze the red clover that's underseeding your oats. But you also bring in some cattle, too?
Well, those are the ones we bring. Like,
those would be the ones that you bring. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
My brother usually brings some over, and neighbors. I'm lucky most of my farms have pastures in them.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all mine, but, you know, it's nice to have that option to bring cows over.
That is huge
for
water.
Yep.
But then just the versatility of that pasture and the timing of whatever weather gives you, if you've got extra grass or if you've got cover crop to go to, open the gate, go in between them. Yeah, that's a huge convenience. I think when we look at these annual grazing systems, that's probably one of the deciding factors that should be thought about. Do you have pasture that you can go to? If you get I think one of the big things is if you get a 3-inch rain and we're soaking wet and you need to pull them off that crop ground that you're grazing on, your annual forage, well, hey, we got to get off. Let's go back to pasture. I think that's a key.
Oh, I think so too. The ones that I've seen work the best, it's always like a quarter that never probably should have been farmed or could, you know, in my part of the world, which we have those, we don't have as many in Minnesota, but that have some challenges anyway, and they're like 80 to 100 acres of his pasture, and then somebody, you know, broke up a 40 to 80 acre chunk out of it, and then it's like, okay, now we can really leverage this hard because we've got an existing pasture water source we can go to back and forth on and off.
You know, another thing that really helps, too, is when you're doing that system, I always liked, especially in the beginning, where the gate where they're going back to water into the pasture, usually like to set a round bale of grass hay sitting there. Doesn't have to be good.
Oh.
But that dry roughage, when they're first introduced to that forage, really helps, because if they have an upset stomach, they'll find it.
Sure.
And if it's right by the door, you know, you watch it and they'll kind of work themselves through it.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the cheapest insurance you can buy is just put a bale of grass hay right by the gate. If they need it, they'll use it.
Yep. Yep.
That's a good point. I always thought when we used to milk cows back when I was in high school, and we had a mineral feeder that had like 10 different kinds of mineral, like straight minerals. Like, oh, you put this over here and put that over there. And it was like 10 different things. And so instead of having a complete mineral package, the idea was they would go literally find out what they needed. And it's kind of amazing to think about that a cow can experiment with 10 different little tubs of different minerals and figure out which one she needs to balance it. Back to that same, you think like, okay, why would they eat the grass hay? Well, they eat the grass hay because they kind of have some sense of how to balance out their rumen in their gut. It's pretty important to them. Like, it's what they do.
So well, it's kind of like us. I mean, if we just ate a Papa Murphy's pizza, I shouldn't say Papa Murphy's, Domino's. What if I say them all? Then do we get endorsed by them all?
Yeah. But the North American Pizza Producers yeah. Association.
Let's say I have some pizza and some salsa and some nacho cheese.
Napa.
And it's late at night and I'm laying in bed and now I got heartburn coming. You're going to go drink a glass of milk, right?
Like you. No, I just about eat more pizza. I don't know if I'd do that. I don't know if I'm smart enough. Like if like, oh, my stomach hurts, I'm going to stop eating chips. You know,
more nacho cheese.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe.
A cow knows.
A cow knows better, I think. I think a cow would know better.
Yeah.
And I'm not too proud to admit that. Good advice, though. That's great advice.
It's cheap and usually helps a lot.
Good tidbit. Can we talk about your involvement with the Minnesota Soy Health Coalition?
Yeah, sure.
I think that's, Minnesota Soy Health Coalition's been around how many years? Five, six?
3 years.
3 years? Okay.
Yep.
Man, wow, good for you guys.
3 years.
Yep.
So let's expand on that. What I mean, you've been there since the very start of it, actively involved.
Yep. Yeah, so just to start, like the Minnesota Soy Health Coalition, kind of our main focus is it's a producer-led and driven organization. And our whole focus is education, just trying to facilitate producer-to-producer knowledge flow. We have a mentor system, but, you know, we all try different things, and usually there's somebody who's tried it. So if we can kind of line up people that want to get started with somebody who's tried some things, if you can avoid some of the pitfalls that happen, that's kind of what we're trying to do. So, yeah, it's like I said, it's been about 3 years, and, it's really grown a lot. Try and put some events around, you know, do a soil health school in the fall and do a bunch of little events during the summer and stuff and a couple of winter ones. And yeah, it's been a fun group, you know, and you kind of, when you get connected with other people that are excited about this stuff that have similar interests, it's nice to bounce ideas off. We on the board, I didn't know most of the guys when I got on the board, and we've gotten to be a really close group of friends. A lot of us talk almost every other day. You know, and it's kind of nice to, hey, I got an idea. Can I bounce this off you, see if it's stupid or not? And it's nice to have that feedback.
Sure. Yeah.
Very, very neat. How many members? Do you know how many members you have?
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Statistic doesn't matter. I know your events are well attended, your, you know, active participation, which is very, very fantastic.
Yeah.
Lots of farm tours, lots of field visits. Yeah, because you're doing a good job.
Yeah, you know, last year, it's just fun to see things starting to open back up after last year. You know, pretty much kind of get your legs taken out from underneath you last year. We couldn't do a lot of events and just with the whole COVID thing.
What did you say?
COVID? We heard about that in South Dakota.
sounds familiar, right?
If you got the news from the outside world told us something about it.
Yes, it is good, and people do want to get back out.
I think we're going to see a lot of well-attended events just because people are just anxious to get back out and do stuff.
Well, the Minnesota State Wrestling Tournament that was held in South Dakota was well-attended by Minnesotans. And that pretty much sums up how the two states responded to COVID differently.
And then it got called a hotspot.
Oh, yeah.
Because there was Minnesota. Six out of 3,200 people that then tested positive with COVID.
And they were... Okay.
Because they were at the Minnesota Youth Wrestling Tournament in South Dakota.
uh, It will be nice to get back to normal, especially now doing outside field days and stuff. What a great time to start it back up again. Yeah. So that's awesome. That's great.
Man, looking back at all those things now,
it's
crazy. Glad where we're at right now.
The whole thing was crazy. Yep. Glad we're back on the right track now.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, darn it. Yep.
It's just weird to look back at when it first happened back last March.
Oh, isn't it?
You know, it's just I remember when they first announced it, we're like, oh my gosh, you're not going to be able to get parts or feet or anything, and you're all nervous. And now I'm like, okay.
Well, and now a year later, we can't get parts.
We could get them then.
Yeah, when it was bad, we could get it. Now that it's getting better, right. Good luck.
Yeah, but it's people aren't working.
Learn how to make your own parts.
Yep. People weren't working. So I was in Washington, D.C. last week, and talking to many people, like professionals in the seed and ag industry, and other places, and it's like this was like the first time that they kind of left their house in like 16 months. Not left their house, but like left the area first, you know, travel for work. And still most large companies are still not allowing their individuals to like travel for work. And it is kind of, you look at it like, what would have happened if everybody in the agriculture community just stopped working for 16 months? What if we just said, nah, not doing it, not going to raise a crop, not going to feed livestock, not going to keep like moving on. We're just going to stop. And all the people in that system, the truck drivers and the delivery people and the processors and the grocery stores and all, like everybody, that if you lived in your basement for 16 months and you feel like somehow, like you don't feel appreciative of the fact that thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of people had to work to allow you to live in your basement for 16 months with things delivered to your house. Like you should really understand that, you know, that only was possible. Like you didn't have enough stuff in your basement to live off for 16 months. Everybody else had to continue to operate for you to live in your basement. And I think it's pretty safe to say, because most of the people that probably all the people that listen to Roots and Ruminants were in that camp that were working.
Yeah.
That had to continue to move on and evolve. And if you weren't, at least appreciate that, understand the, you know, what everybody else had to go through to keep things moving.
Yeah.
Well, even, you know, and on a positive side, some people learn how to do a lot more stuff themselves.
Yeah.
Like things like getting laying hens in.
Oh, yeah.
Chicks last year. That was nuts.
The homesteading movement. Yeah,
the amount of chickens that people started buying. And you started hearing some stupid prices for, like, people like, hey, I've got laying hens. You want to pay $30 for them?
Like, no thanks.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm raising myself.
$30, you can take your pick of every bird I got on the farm. Yeah. I don't care.
Mine are for sale.
Yeah. Take some cats with you too.
It's like a you pick it chicken farm.
Yeah.
You catch it, you keep it, $30 a piece.
Do they have egg farms like that?
That'd be a good idea.
They got strawberry patches.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Patches. You pick it. You pick the eggs, they're yours.
Yeah, but have you ever found, like, when the hens get out and they find that special place to lay eggs that you haven't found for a long time, and then you go there and you find, like, 40 eggs in one spot, and you're like, how long has this been going on? I don't trust any of these eggs.
Where you pick them up and you give them to the kids and they go out in the grove, find a tree, and start breaking them up, practice throwing an arm.
Yeah, that's kind of how that goes.
Because like, you don't know. So
you don't know.
I'm not going to float test them all to see if they're kind of bad. So.
No, is it 20 chickens? You know, 2 days worth of eggs, that's fine. Is it one chicken that showed up, you know, once a week for the last year and laid a bunch of eggs? I don't know. You don't know.
Break it open and it's green inside.
That'll kind of turn you off eggs. Although it rarely ever happens. They're so shelf. I mean, the crazy thing is it probably be just fine.
Yep.
They could have been there for 2 months and they'd be fine. Unwashed eggs don't go bad. It's like we're the only country in the world that actually refrigerates chicken eggs. You go over like Europe and Asia and whatever, like they sell eggs on the street corner in little baggies.
Yeah, but they also do that with meat in China.
Yeah, and it's delicious. It is.
Okay.
It just accelerates the wet aging or the dry aging process.
Nice and tender that way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Two good days at 85 degrees Fahrenheit is like the same thing as 2 weeks in a cooler. It's not. That's made up. That's a totally made up thing.
Don't write that down.
Just
scrape off the green stuff and away you go.
For those of you that are using this for curriculum,
that part was false.
That was false.
Like a prosciutto ham, though.
Oh, yeah.
Prosciutto ham that just sits and dry ages.
Gotta get the moisture out.
Years.
Gotta get the moisture out first, though. Get some salt in there.
Lovely.
Yeah, and then they sell it for just an unreal amount of money.
Oh, yeah.
That's your natural cure.
Where did we start? Oh, COVID disruption. We don't need to go back to that. Let's talk about chickens. Yeah, it is crazy. Now we have the shortages. Now we have the shortages. Didn't before.
Wild.
Well, you know, even things like piping for pastures and stuff is hard to come by. Like the, you know, the black poly pipe.
Black poly pipe laying the ground, yeah.
Do you do fencing. Most above ground pipe?
Yep.
To everything?
I do have one heated winterized one up in the yard.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it's pretty much all above ground.
And then you got valves every so often that you're connecting holes in the tank onto? Or how do you?
I have tanks all over the pasture.
Okay. Permanent tanks? Or are you? Okay.
If I could have done it differently, I would have put quick attach valves throughout the whole thing and had tanks on skids.
Okay.
Give you a little more flexibility.
Sure.
So I do a lot of alleyways and stuff like that.
Yep,
but
yep. Fence into water still that way. Yep.
But, yeah, and it's important to make sure you have a valve on every tank to shut off, because if you leave them all full of water, you're going to come by and find something blowing and pump water for a week before you can see it.
Yep. Yep. What about your fencing system? I mean, if you're doing daily moves, you've got to be pretty efficient with how you move and how you operate.
Yeah, probably the biggest thing I learned was, so if I go move them today, I'm going to set up, as soon as I move them, I'm setting up tomorrow's right away.
Okay.
So I'm so that way when I get out there, I just roll up the poly wire, let them eat, and then I set up tomorrow's. Because if you missed gauged and they're hungry and you're trying to set up poly wire.
Yeah.
Even with really good trained cows, somebody's going to get antsy.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're running two groups of cattle and they can see each other.
Yeah.
And they're watching those guys get moved, and they're not, they're going to start helping themselves if you're not careful.
Oof.
So that's why we start getting, at least that way, if somebody does jump over, okay, they're just in today's.
Yep.
That takes a lot of headache out of it. But you get pretty used to it, and, you know, usually it's like you can move in about a half hour. It doesn't take real long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you can keep the portion of poly wire that you're moving down to like 600 to 1,000 feet, it doesn't take long to do it.
Yeah, yep. You're just running by with pigtail posts and...
Yeah. I shouldn't even say 1,000. No, more like 6. I mean, that's... Yeah. The shorter you got to move, you know, if you got a nice long rectangular where the short end is where you're moving, you can really get stuff done.
Yeah.
I wouldn't... Looking back, I wouldn't have probably put as many interior fences in as I did.
A lot of people said that so far on the podcast. This, several times that's come up.
I wish I would have learned about polywire just years before I did. I mean, that's like the round baler. You know, of pasture management. It's one of them things. I'm like, whoa, wouldn't my grandparents have loved to have had this when they were running cows back in the day?
Yeah, I have to refamiliarize myself with polywire, because my first experience with polywire was using polywire as a way to electrify an existing poor barbed wire fence. Right?
That's not going to work.
It doesn't work.
Too flimsy.
But we had a landlord that was like, this is cheaper. Oh, you know, or like the guy on the pasture is like, this is cheaper. It cost me less money because, you know, smooth wire was so much money. But anyway, so we did that, and that does not work. Polywire and regular wires do not mix. Yeah. But polywire by itself,
See, and we have high tensile around the outside.
Okay.
Yes, and then high tensile.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you just got to connect onto it.
You never have enough of those little jumper clips.
Okay. Yeah.
Buy way more than you ever need.
Yeah.
Because you're going to lose them, and they're going to get chewed on by coyotes and calves and things.
They do get chewed on.
Yep. It's amazing. You'd think they'd get zapped in the face. But
So
do you have any barbed wire? Is just all high tensile and then...
Okay, I actually have barbed wire on the outside.
Yeah.
It's four strands of barbed wire.
Oh, okay. And one.
With one high tensile.
That's what we do.
Because you never know when you're going to have that power outage. And and we'll try and stay out as late into winter. And if you got 4 feet of snow and an electric fence running through the middle of it, at least you know you can shut it off and keep them in.
Yeah, good point. Red brand hard barbed wire is getting hard to get, by the way. Speaking of disruptions, you tried to get any lately? Well, it's out. Can't get any. If you wanted to get like 8 rolls of barbed wire, you're probably going to visit 2 to 3 runnings. Some are even rationing it. Barbed wire rationing is a thing.
You just made that up.
Right? No. Like you could probably get the OK Corral stuff or whatever that, you know, the off,
okay.
the off stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But red brand,
huh.
Can't get it. I don't think. Sponsored by Red Brand. No, I don't. That's what I've been hearing. That's what's going on in the countryside. Yep. I'm going to go check it out over noon. Let's go to Runnings.
All right.
Let's go see
if they have a sign.
I'm going to ground truth this.
One roll per customer.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll take everybody from the office. We need 20 people to stand in line, get one roll of wire. And it's gotten expensive.
Yeah. Well, everything has.
Yeah.
Except inflation. Inflation hasn't. It said no inflation. They said no inflation. Listen to them, Justin. They said no inflation. It's fine. Nothing's more expensive. The government said. We didn't inflate. Everything just got 50% more expensive. So you just have to.
It's not inflation.
It's not inflation. It's just, clearly not
it's
inflation.
It's all in our head.
It's all in your head, yeah. You just pay more for things than you used to. It's fine.
Gotta love it. Ben, what did we miss that you're like, oh, I should have told them about this?
We covered a lot of ground. I don't know.
I love the diversity of what you're doing, and it fits so well into everything that we've visited about with all the other people that we've had on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Diverse, opportunistic, entrepreneurial, and you're caring about the land and you're caring about the livestock. So this has been great. Certainly appreciate the time that you've taken to do this. And there's going to be so many people that listen to this and go, man, I learned so much from Ben talking about his red clover or his oats or his grazing or his cow. I mean, there's, yeah, a lot of good educational pieces. So thank you so much.
Yeah, for being it was on. Fun
really
to be
really
here.
Appreciate it. So anything to close, Jared?
No, thanks, Ben. It's alrighty. Awesome.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for listening again to the Roots and Ruminants podcast, and stay tuned. In a couple of weeks, we'll get you another episode coming.
See you next time.
All right, we'll see you.